This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
No course on nutrition would be complete without talking about vitamins and minerals. We focused a lot on macronutrients over the first part of the course and a couple of diseases related to macronutrients. But vitamins and minerals, of course, are a big part of nutrition. It's what we call the micronutrients. A lot of the fascinating history of nutrition derived from the discovery of the vitamins through discovery of vitamin deficiency diseases. You know many of those stories, and Dr. Tice will probably refer to a few of them. But the controversy, when we look at how many people are taking vitamin and mineral supplements, the numbers are staggering. And the question is that the right thing to do? And if so, which ones? And so we wanted to really address that head on so that you can make good decisions and discuss those decisions with your healthcare professionals. Jeff is a member of our Division of General Internal Medicine. He's an internal medicine specialist. He's an associate professor of medicine. He's one of our outstanding primary care general internal medicine physicians. And he's also an outstanding teacher and runs many of the teaching programs for our medical students. But probably most of all, Jeff is really an expert at looking at the medical literature and helping sort out noise from real science. And that's what we've asked him to do on this very challenging topic. He's written several important papers on this topic, which he's provided in the cover sheet as a bibliography. And I think you'll find his name on many of them, many others, if you search through the medical literature. But tonight we've asked him to talk on vitamins and supplements, an evidence-based approach. Jeff?
Thanks, Bobby. It's great to be here. I'm impressed that everybody's coming on such a rare, beautiful night in San Francisco, warm and actually not very windy. But I'm glad that you're interested. I'm happy to take questions as we go along, but I'd like to keep most of the questions relevant to the material just covered. And additional questions, please hold them to the end, and I'm happy to take them. And if we run out of time, I'm happy to stay after and chat with people. People have lots and lots of questions on this. There's a lot of information and misinformation, and so I'll do my best to answer your questions as we go along. So I have no conflicts of interest in this. So there's been a tremendous interest in sort of packaging food into pills. It's an American phenomenon, I think, to try and get away, make things more efficient, faster. And the question is, you know, can we really replicate or improve upon nutrition with these pills? And there's been, as I alluded to, a tremendous amount of stuff in the popular literature. Always like vitamin D helps increase longevity. Oh, it's associated with an increased risk of death. Vitamins to increase longevity. Dietary supplements may increase health risks. So there's everything around there. And I'm going to try and give you a little bit of an understanding about why you have this conflicting evidence and hopefully help you sort through the literature where we do have answers and point out where things are still some unanswered questions that are still out there. This is what I'm going to try and cover today. I'll start with the antioxidants briefly. When I was in medical training, they were all the rage. Many physicians were taking these and promoting them for our patients. The beta-carotene and vitamin A. Beta-carotene is really a precursor for vitamin A. Vitamin E is the most studied and talked about. Though, of course, vitamin C with colds and Linus Pauling also has a tremendous amount of interest. Then something that I got excited about through all this was folic acid and B vitamins, mainly to lower homocysteine and hopefully prevent strokes and heart attacks. I've done a lot of work in that and was very promising. I'll show you the data there. And then turn to the vitamins and supplements that are really in the news these days, vitamin D, calcium, and the omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, or fish oil. So we'll try and get a show of hands for this. These data are a little old. They're from the late 2000s, around 2010 or so. But about what percentage of folks do you think regularly use vitamin supplements? 0 to 20%? Raise your hands. Just 21 to 40%? 41 to 60%. All right, 61 to 80. All right, good. And 81 to 100%. Few people think that. So pretty good. Normal distribution right around 41 to 60%. So if you looked ahead, a little over half of Americans use, this is vitamin supplements. This isn't actually talking about all the other supplements that are out there. And the number has more than doubled since the 1970s. This is using representative data from surveys called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey that's done periodically in the U.S. and gives representative data for the entire United States. And we see that it's increased dramatically. In 2009, almost $10 billion was spent on vitamin supplements. Reports from mostly observational studies are really popular with patients and end up on the front page of newspapers all the time. So why are they so popular? Well, you know, as Bobby alluded to, many of us grew up hearing about stories of vitamin deficiencies as our parents were trying to get us to eat right and teachers were trying to get us to eat right in elementary school. One of the classics is vitamin C deficiency, scurvy, where you have bleeding gums and, just general malaise. And, one of the probably the first randomized trial ever done was giving citrus fruits or other things to sailors in the British Navy. That's how they discovered that citrus fruits could prevent or treat and prevent scurvy. And it was a British physician who did that. That of course led to British sailors being limeys. Rickets, a bone disease of children, is due to vitamin D deficiency. Beriberi is due to thiamine deficiency. Our philosophy in America is, if a little bit's good, give us more, supersize me. And the question is whether that's really right, whether using more than what we need to prevent diseases of deficiency is better, whether that really helps us. So who uses supplements? If you look at these same studies that measure who's taking vitamin supplements, they also capture a lot of other information about their health habits and their health status. People who take supplements tend to be concerned about their health. They're more educated. They already exercise more. They're more likely to eat a healthy diet already. They eat more fruits and vegetables. They are thinner. They're less likely to smoke. They're less likely to have diabetes. They have lower blood pressure. They're healthier. So when we look, when we have observational studies, not experiments, not randomized trials, but studies where we just see who's taking supplements and who's not, and we follow them forward over time, we find they're healthier people, they get less disease. So the supplements generally look better. And we try and use statistical methods to control for that, but almost always we still have issues with what the statisticians and the researchers call confounding, where there may be other things. The fact that healthier people are taking these supplements, that may be why supplements look good in the literature when we do observational studies, and why I'm going to try and show you the data from some experiments, what we call randomized trials, where half the people get the supplement and half get something that they think is the supplement, and we see over time who does better. And, you know, as a physician, I take this very seriously. You know, I'm charged to do no harm. And when we're talking about health promotion and preventing diseases, you want to really make sure that what you're recommending is beneficial for patients, that on balance, the benefits outweigh the harms. And it's not just due to, you know, good ideas from basic science and, observational studies. I mean, my feeling is when you're telling a healthy person, take this to maintain your health or promote your health, we really ought to know that that's good. It's different when somebody comes to you with, arthritis or a urinary tract infection. I mean, you don't need quite the same level of evidence to try and fix them. But when somebody's healthy and I'm telling them to take something, I really want to know that what I'm offering is really going to do them good. And that's why we need large randomized trials for things that we are trying to prevent disease or trying to promote health. So now I'm going to turn to the antioxidants. Tremendous amount of laboratory data, basic science data, and animal research showing that antioxidants prevent damage from free radicals. Free radicals are these reactive chemicals that get formed in oxidative reactions in the body. They're generated all the time, and they damage cells, tissue, and are associated with all the sort of phenotypes of aging. They're associated with cancer, associated with heart disease, associated with aging skin and all kinds of stuff. So people felt, ideally we give antioxidants. And it was noted that many healthy foods have antioxidants. All these, you know, not a lot of, maybe in some of the talks you got talked about eating lots of different colors. Well, many of those colored vegetables, the reds and oranges and yellows, come from carotenoids, and beta-carotene is one. So the idea was, this should be a good thing. And, beta-carotene, we'll start with that. You know, as I said, it's in the red and yellow and orange fruits and vegetables. I have a couple up here listed. It's important, we know, for vision, mostly through vitamin A, but it's also important in cellular differentiation, going from very primitive kind of basic cells that cancers, aggressive cancers, are not well differentiated to more differentiated forms. So there's some thought that that may be important in preventing cancers. It also is important for immune function, so potentially for preventing infections, and it's an antioxidant. And really, we thought it was pretty safe. Mostly when people eat lots of carrots, they get in the creases of their palms, it turns yellow there, but we didn't think there was much harm to the carotenoids and to beta-carotene in particular. And we had lots of observational data, actually, that people who had higher levels of beta-carotene in their blood got lower rates of cancer, particularly lung cancer. As you all know, lung cancer is the number one cancer killer of both men and women. So there's a lot of interest in trying to prevent it, since the studies that we had, particularly in the 80s, 90s, and our early 2000s, of screening for lung cancer really showed no benefit. So this is one of several large randomized trials of beta-carotene. This one was done in the United States, 18,000 smokers, former smokers, or people who were exposed to asbestos. They were enrolled in 1985 in Seattle. They were older, so that they were higher risk of cancer, and about a third were women, two-thirds men. For the initial analysis, they had 4 years of follow-up, and they were given both beta-carotene and vitamin A so that they could examine both of those as potential protective elements, and they were randomized to those. Primarily looking at lung cancer, that was the primary hypothesis because the observational data suggested big benefits there, but they also looked at all-cause mortality and cardiovascular death. And this was a randomized trial, not observational. And here are the primary findings. So if you looked at death from all causes, those who got the active treatment, the vitamin A and beta carotene, they died more often. This is cumulative mortality, 1% death, 2% death. So the curve that's higher, these are people who are dying more often. So those who got the beta carotene died more often. And they died from cardiovascular disease. They also got more lung cancer. And there were two other randomized trials of beta carotene that showed the same thing. There was a 50% increase in lung cancer deaths in the beta carotene arms, almost 46%, I think. So absolutely the opposite of what was expected. Again, in the observational studies, observational studies where we measured levels in the blood, and even in this study, actually, they measured levels in the blood, and those who had high levels of beta carotene to begin with got less lung cancer. But guess what? That's probably because they ate a healthy diet. They were healthier in general. And it wasn't the beta carotene. Again, when we randomized people to beta carotene, they didn't know which they got. They actually did worse. So what about vitamin E? That was our favorite antioxidant. It used to be called factor X. It's actually a group of fat-soluble compounds, the tocopherols. It's rare to be deficient, but they are the most important fat-soluble antioxidants. I put the RDA here. It's about 22 international units for men and women. But the supplements, were usually 200, 300, 400 international units. So 10 to 20 times the recommended daily allowance. So the idea was more antioxidants, suck up all these free radicals, less damage, And that we'd have benefit. So I just listed a number of foods that are high in vitamin E. They're fatty things, the wheat germ, oils, egg yolks, and so on. Nuts have a lot of vitamin E, and put where Americans tend to get vitamin E in their diet. So I want to show you one of the observational studies before I turn to the randomized trial. So this is one you may have heard about, the Nurses Health Study. For this analysis, there were almost 90,000 nurses who had no evidence of heart disease, no strokes, no cancer, and followed them for 8 years looking at mostly heart disease outcomes and their association with vitamin E intake. So this is the vitamin E intake, and these are broken up into sort of fifths of vitamin E intake. So the lowest fifth, their average intake was only 2.8 international units a day, so below the RDA, 4.2 for the next, 5.9, 17, and then, woo, the upper group, they were eating about 200 international units a day. So these folks were all taking supplements, so they weren't getting this from food. And look, there's once you get up to the higher levels, you see a nice stepwise decrease in the risk for cardiovascular events, for, in this case, heart attacks or death from heart disease. So this was observational data. The women who were, and these are nurses, generally healthy, very health aware, who were taking supplements, so high levels of vitamin E, they had a 34% reduction in the risk for heart attacks or death from heart disease. So they cut their risk by about a third, it looked like, in observational studies. So the women who were taking this had a lower risk of heart attacks and death from heart disease. So then there's a really important study, the Women's Health Study. This also looked at aspirin in women. 40,000 women who were at least 45 years old were randomized to vitamin E at 600 international units every other day, so about 300 a day, and followed for 10 years. And lo and behold, no effect on cancer, no benefit for any of the cardiovascular events, for stroke, for heart attack, for death from heart disease. So again, no benefit. And there are a ton of studies out there because these, we're very, very excited about it, though. Basic scientists were excited about it. Us as clinicians and clinician researchers were really excited about it. You know, oxidative damage, we still believe that that's a major cause of diseases of aging. So there are 47 randomized trials of antioxidants, over 180,000 people, and followed long enough so 25,000 of these people have died in while they've been following them. And the randomized trials of vitamin A showed overall a significant, you know, we're using our statistics, this is unlikely to be due to chance, a 16% increase in total mortality, in death, in those who were randomized to vitamin A rather than placebo, the identical placebo pill. Beta-carotene, less, only 7%, but a real increase. Vitamin E, a 4% increase, and statistically significant, meaning that there were enough trials with large enough follow-up to conclusively know that it's certainly not beneficial, and the evidence really, using our standard of proof in medicine, it's proved that vitamin E is, on average, for most people, it's harmful. And even vitamin C, which we think of as pretty safe, it's also an antioxidant, but it's water-soluble, so we urinate out most of the vitamin C. It doesn't accumulate. These three are fat-soluble, so they can stick around in the body. You can build up to higher levels. But the vitamin C, we usually urinate. We thought that would be really safe, but even there's a trend towards an increase, actually a bigger increase than vitamin E, but we don't have a lot of large randomized trials with many people followed for many years, so this didn't reach our level of statistical significance of it being less than a 5% chance that this finding was due just to random error. The bottom line here is that none of the antioxidants appear beneficial overall for longevity. So why? You know, there's a lot of theories about this, and the people doing the research think that, you know, maybe there are some benefits to controlled oxidative damage. In fact, there's good evidence that there is, that we use oxidation to kill bacteria. So we may be working against ourselves. And we also use oxidative processes to kill off damaged cells. I mean, the body recognizes cells that are cancer and kills them off. And it may be that by giving high levels of antioxidants, we're actually interfering with some of these processes. And even though we're getting some benefit, on balance, we're actually doing more harm than good. This is not proven. This is one of the theories that's out there about why they didn't work. And I should say, there's some evidence for some things that vitamin C actually does work. So for preventing colds, there's good randomized trial data than in people who really stress themselves. So it's known that like after marathons for a couple of weeks, they're more susceptible to colds and flus and things like that. But if you give them vitamin C, you drop that by about 50%. The same thing with athletic skiers, people who are really training, working really hard, or soldiers who are out on sub-Arctic exercises. Giving regular vitamin C doses at 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day actually cut the incidence of colds. In general people, public people who weren't really stressing themselves, there was no reduction in colds in the randomized trials, but there's a small reduction in duration. So there may be some benefit preventing colds with vitamin C, but that probably doesn't mean that we should be taking it and promoting it in general, since the evidence suggests taking it regularly at high doses may increase your risk of dying long term. All right. So I'm going to turn from the antioxidants now to the vitamins that lower homocysteine, mostly folic acid, and talk mostly about heart disease. That's where the interest is. There is a disease we learn about in medical school called homocystinuria. It's a genetic disease involved with metabolism and of cysteine. This thing called homocysteine builds up in the blood. Normally, it gets recycled and reused, but with these genetic diseases, you can't metabolize homocysteine, and the homocysteine builds up in the blood to very high levels, 100 to 400 micromoles per liter. But just remember the 100 to 400, whereas for most of us, the normal range is 8 to 12. So we're talking 40 times higher than normal for people. I mean, it's pretty rare, 1 in 150,000 or so live births. What happens to these children? It turns out about half of them have a stroke or a heart attack by the time they're 30. So they get a lot of really early heart disease, strokes. Part of it is clotting in general. They also get clots in their veins, but part of it is clots in the arteries that lead to strokes and heart attacks. They also have a number of other things. They get early osteoporosis. They have funny dislocation of the lenses in the eye, and some have cognitive deficits. And we've learned that lowering the homocysteine in these kids can help to prevent the heart disease. But what about people in more normal ranges? Remember, it's the sort of 8 to 12 and a little bit higher. So this is a study in about 1,000 people who had a heart attack, or no, had proven coronary artery disease. They had cardiac catheterization, so injecting dye in the arteries, feeding the heart, and they see large blockages, so high risk for heart disease, known heart disease. And they looked at their risk of dying from anything. Most died from heart disease based on their homocysteine levels. And if they were low, below 9, that was sort of the comparison group. If they were at the high end of normal, they had a threefold risk of dying. If they were a little more elevated, it was up to 6. And if they were above 20, they had a tenfold risk of dying compared to those with the low normal. So remarkable risk for death in these folks, just based on the homocysteine level, and nowhere near 100 to 400. So this is just sort of high normal ranges. So lots of excitement. There are many, many studies like this documenting associations with heart attacks, strokes, and death from heart disease. So just like with the antioxidants, people jumped on the bandwagon. This is an inexpensive intervention. Could save a lot of lives. So we have over 40 randomized trials looking at just lowering homocysteine. And it shows that folic acid, this is a B vitamin, at not high doses, 600 to 1,000 micrograms a day, so up to a milligram a day, pretty low, above the RDA, but not a whole lot, reduces your homocysteine levels on average by about 25%. And if you add B12 at sort of normal levels, you go down another 7%, so about a 33% reduction in homocysteine levels with simple, inexpensive vitamins, a B complex, basically. So, did it work? I'm not going to spend lots of time. This is an area I did research in. There was a large meta-analysis where they actually not just had the sort of published studies, but they actually got the data from each of the studies. And that allows them to do more detailed analysis of what's going on. So 8 large randomized trials, again, where half the people got the B vitamins and half didn't. There were 5,000 deaths, almost 10,000 strokes and heart attacks, and 3,000 cancers. To look and see whether lowering homocysteine with B vitamins prevented those. And you already know what I'm going to say. But the homocysteine worked. The therapy worked. So when they measured homocysteine levels in those who were randomized to the B vitamins, it went down by 25%. So that went down in the control group as well, probably because some were going out and taking some, partly because when some of these studies were going on, we started adding folate to flour. In the United States, and that had some effect on homocysteine levels, but didn't prevent dying in any of these randomized trials. And again, these are 5 to 8 years of follow-up. Most importantly, no reduction in cardiovascular events, no reduction in heart attacks, no reduction in strokes, no reduction in death from heart disease, and no reduction in cancer. And in fact, you see the relative risks are right around one. The relative risks are just the risk in one group divided by the risk in the other. So the risk number of people, roughly percentage of people who got who died in the homocysteine group over the number of people who died the percentage of people who died in the placebo group. And if it worked, it should be less than one. So if it's 0.7, that would mean a 30% reduction in death. If it's 1, that means equal proportion of people in each group died. So absolutely no difference. And if it's greater than 1, that actually means there's a tendency towards harm. That actually they had more of the events that we're interested in, we're looking at. So the trend is actually towards more events in all three of these. So absolutely no, even not even a hint that it was beneficial. And we use something called confidence intervals to look at what are reasonable estimates of the effect side. What's the range of reasonable estimates given the data that we have? And you see that they're pretty tight around one. So the data say it's still plausible that the B vitamins could lower total mortality by 3%, but it's also plausible that it could increase it by 8%. Sort of that's the reasonable range. And so there's not going to be a big reduction given this data. And there are a couple of other randomized trials now. Again, as a general internist, I take a broad view on health, and I have all of my women of childbearing age, whether or not they're thinking about getting pregnant, strongly consider taking a folic acid supplement, a folate supplement, because there's tremendous randomized trial evidence that you decrease the risk of certain kinds of birth defects, what we call neural tube defects, where the spinal cord sort of and the brain starts as a flat layer of cells, and then during development it rolls over and becomes a tube. And if that doesn't happen, you get spina bifida, you get the brain not fully forming, so anencephaly, so a number of birth defects related to that. And it turns out that folic acid or folate can prevent that. So in women who'd already had a child with one of these neural tube defects, if they gave high levels of folates or 4 milligrams or 400 micrograms a day, they lowered the risk of a second child with that birth defect by 70%, so more than half. And in women who'd never had a baby with a neural tube defect, it also reduced it 63%, so more than half, by giving just a low level of folate. So this is sort of the RDA level of folate, 0.4 milligrams a day. And then partly based on this evidence, in the late 90s or maybe early 2000s, I can't remember exactly when now, the United States required manufacturers of flour products to add folic acid to it. And since then, observationally, we've seen the rates of neural tube defects in the country go down by about 50%. So this really seems to work. And so this is a subgroup where the benefits outweigh the harms. Women who are thinking about having children, and this is not high dose. This is just really making sure women are getting the RDA levels of folate. if they're thinking about having children. I'm going to turn briefly to multivitamins, partly because there was a big study published in 2011 that got a lot of press, and some of the headlines that I showed on my second or third slide came from the public response to this. So there was an observational study, the Iowa Women's Study. Almost 39,000 women who were initially 55 to 69 years old, and they followed them for almost 20 years. And one of the things they asked, and they asked repeatedly, are you taking a multivitamin daily? And so they updated that periodically. And around 2010, they analyzed the data and looked at it, just that it wasn't one of the primary things they were looking at, but there's so much interest in vitamins these days, somebody did. And lo and behold, there was a 6% increase in total mortality in women who were taking multivitamins. And this is after adjustment for everything. And that translated into a 2.4% absolute increase in mortality. So one out of 50 women over those 20 years who died maybe didn't need to if this was causal. We don't know that this is causal. This is observational. But it certainly is strong evidence that multivitamins are probably not helping most people. There's never been a randomized trial that showed that multivitamins help, except if you want to think there were some studies in rural China where there's a lot of vitamin deficiencies, and they gave some targeted supplements there. In those trials, there actually was big benefits in terms of preventing mostly cancers there. So again, repleting deficiency, yes. Should take your RDA, ideally from food would be my advice, cutting to the end of the talk, but don't take big doses. All right. So now I'm going to turn to sort of the vitamin du jour, I think, right now, vitamin D. I an interesting patient. This is a real patient of mine, Veronica, 57-year-old woman. She's got Paget's disease, diabetes, depression. She's got chronic pain. She had a recently unexplained iron deficiency, even after endoscopies looking at her esophagus and stomach and in small intestines and large intestine. I've been hearing about all this vitamin D stuff, so I ordered a vitamin D level, partly because I was concerned about malabsorption. So there's, you probably heard of something called celiac disease, a small disease of the small bowel, can lead to vitamin D deficiency, which is why I ordered the vitamin D, and iron deficiency. And so I was concerned about that in her. And it came back as 7. I'm like, I don't know what to do about that. What do I do now? And I'll tell you what those levels mean in a minute. So just in 1 year, from 2008 to 2009, sales of vitamin D almost doubled. And there's been even more press about it since then. So it's definitely the vitamin of the moment. And this is the vitamin that prevents rickets in children. And that's how we thought of it as a vitamin, something you need to prevent a disease. But really, it's not a typical vitamin. It's really a pro-hormone that the body turns into a hormone, and it's tightly regulated. So the hormonal form is called 1,2,5-dihydroxyvitamin D. It means it's got 2 hydroxy units on it. And that's really important for managing the amount of calcium and phosphorus that your body absorbs in the diet. And if you don't have enough, then the body puts out something called PTH, or parathyroid hormone. And one of the things that parathyroid hormone does is it tells the bone to give up its calcium and phosphorus so that the body has enough to use in other processes, because calcium is really important for lots of things. So if you have adequate levels of vitamin D, high levels of 1,2,5-dihydroxyvitamin D, your PTH goes down, you're not absorbing calcium from the bones, your bones stay stronger, it's important for muscular function. And even more intriguing to scientists and people who like to hypothesize on pathways is it regulates up to 10% of the genes in the human body. So it crosses the nuclear membrane, binds to different segments of the DNA with carrier protein, and upregulates or downregulates the transcription of 10% of genes in the human genome. So potentially lots of effects from vitamin D above and beyond the calcium. So partly because of all the interest, the Institute of Medicine re-looked at data. They had put out a prior report in 1997, and this is the body that puts out our recommended daily allowances for vitamins and minerals and supplements. And they looked at, in 2010, this came out at the end of 2010, they looked at calcium and vitamin D together because vitamin D and calcium are sort of linked in many, many ways. And they reviewed over 1,000 studies looking at 25 different health outcomes, so not just fractures, not just falls, but a bunch of different cancers and lots of things, autoimmune diseases, and I'll talk about why in just a minute. So really updated the book on vitamin D and calcium. And the bottom line is they say for most of us adults, 600 international units a day. When you're over 70, you probably need a little bit more. You're not absorbing as much. You may just need a little bit more for to stimulate absorption of calcium and so on. So they increased it to 800 international units a day. This is up. They're up essentially 200 international units from the earlier recommendations. It used to say 400 and 600, I think. So they increased it somewhat, and that's enough to meet the needs of almost everybody. If you don't have, if you haven't had surgeries that affect your absorption of vitamin D, if you don't have chronic pancreatitis, or you have trouble absorbing fats and fat-soluble vitamins, if you don't have celiac disease, this is enough for you. So it should be fine for everybody without specific disease processes that affect absorption of vitamin D. Just to show what normal levels are, remember my patient, I think it was a 7 or a 9, so she was very low. She was clearly deficient. And in the United States, we use these units, nanograms per milliliter. I put the other units up here because many studies publish these because the rest of the world uses these international units, so nanomoles per liter. But it's pretty easy to convert between the two. You just multiply by 2.5. Or divide by 2.5 if you're going the other way. But these are the numbers you'll see on your lab tests that your doctor might order. So if you're less than 12, clearly deficient, these people need to be repleted, and you may want to think about diseases of malabsorption if you're a physician. Insufficient is 12 to 20, and you'll see many of us are there. Sufficient is above 20. In our lab at UCSF, it comes back, and anything less than 30 is labeled as low. But the Institute of Medicine said, looking at all the data, really this should be sufficient. And there's theoretical reasons why higher might be better, but that's really just scientific hypotheses, haven't been proven. If you're above 20, you should have plenty for absorbing enough calcium for what you need, for preserving your bones, for muscular function, and so on. And above 50 is potentially harmful. So these are kind of good guidelines. And the harmful problem is high calcium, high phosphorus. It mostly leads to constipation, an upset stomach, kidney stones. People feel depressed. Those are the main kind of symptoms when you have too much vitamin D. So how common is this? I've alluded to this a little bit. This less than 12, so clearly too low. About 10% of people. These data are for women over the age of 14, but and men it's a little bit less, but pretty comparable. So for women, about 10% of women, 1 in 10 women have very low levels. About a third of women have low levels, lower than 20, so lower than they should and should need. You know, really should take a supplement to raise it up. And for less than 30, which is what my endocrinology colleagues think is what we really need and what our lab says, 8 out of 10 people, so almost everybody in the United States, is deficient by this. And why? So vitamin D, normally we make it ourselves. You don't need to eat it. The body makes it. Sunlight hits the skin. The UV radiation causes a reaction that generates vitamin D. So we used to live outside all the time, be out in the sun. We didn't live in the fog and clothes and all of that. And we used to have more than enough vitamin D. In fact, we made too much, which is why in some parts of the world, skin got darker in part to block production of vitamin D because you didn't need so much. That's how we maintain adequate vitamin D. But a sunscreen at 8 or higher on SPF will block vitamin D production. And tinted windows, smog, even window screens are enough to block most of the synthesis. So most of us need something, and for those of us in San Francisco, in fact, most of the United States, the sun's not strong enough in the winter to make enough vitamin D to meet our needs. And that's why if you look at data over time, our vitamin D levels always go down in the winter and come back up in the summertime. But they go too low in most of the United States, and the same thing happens for south of 35 degrees below the equator in their winter, so our summer. So sources of vitamin D, this was the question. The main source used to be sunlight, and it actually doesn't take very much. 10 or 15 minutes out in the sun is more than enough to make your what you need in a day. But cod liver oil that grandma used to want to give you is a great source. Also has omega-3s. That's the RDA. One teaspoon, 600 international units is the RDA now. So a teaspoon plus what you're getting elsewhere is probably enough. Milk is fortified, so you get your calcium and your vitamin D in milk. Egg yolks. Fatty fishes are a big source. Again, we now fortify a lot of orange juice with calcium and vitamin D. And mushrooms, interestingly, have high amounts of vitamin D. It varies, and all kinds of mushrooms. The buttons and the crimonies have lower amounts. The shiitakes and the morels, they have high amounts. And they can actually, because this is popular, if you expose them, mushrooms, to ultraviolet light, they'll generate more. So there's actually a movement to generate more vitamin D naturally in mushrooms by exposing them to a little extra vitamin, ultraviolet light.
Is it stored? Are we talking about average?
This is average, yes. Yeah, yeah. It varies very much from mushroom and mushroom crop to mushroom crop.
In terms of the body's requirement.
Oh, is it stored? So yeah, I'll get to that. But yes, it's a fat-soluble vitamin. Actually, if you take high amounts, it will build up in the body. And when people lose a lot of weight, actually, vitamin D levels go up because you release stuff that was stored in fat when you start to mobilize fat in your body. But yes, you absorb it. So as opposed to water-soluble vitamins where you need sort of daily doses, if you have high doses, and actually we'll talk about that, that's one of the excitements for, one of the uses is to prevent fractures. And a lot of studies would give one megadose a year, and that would be enough to keep the levels up for the whole year. For those people who are really low, we usually give high doses once a week, again, because you don't need it daily, to get people back up, and then go to the RDA. I probably go a little bit above the RDA because for some reason they were down low, 800 to to 1,000 international units a day, mainly because the 1,000 international unit pills are available very inexpensively over the counter now. For people who are insufficient, below 20, I think it's fine actually just to get them taking a supplement. There's no reason to rapidly replete most people, and there's some evidence that I'll talk about that may be harmful. With that, you'll be up to normal levels within 2 or 3 months. So that's when I would check again if for some reason I was checking a level to begin with. And again, the upper limit, according to the Institute of Medicine, for a safe daily dose is 4,000 international units a day. Again, much more than most of us need to get adequate levels in the body. And if you're looking at supplements, you'll see that there are two kinds. Those 50,000 unit a day pills that only comes in a form of vitamin D called vitamin D2 or ergocalciferol. The plant sources actually make this kind of vitamin D. We and other animals make a form called vitamin D3 or cholecalciferol, but functionally they're the same. There's really no difference, so it doesn't matter. And that's why traditionally in the United States we've used D2 because it was less expensive, easier to manufacture. Now, because of all the hype on vitamin D, everybody wants something as natural as possible. So most of the supplements are available as D3, and that's what I recommend for patients. But functionally, really, there's essentially no difference between the two. So, on to the prevention part. Now, I've talked about deficiency, and I think repleting deficiency is important, but should we be recommending them for prevention? And I'm going to start first with the easy topic, fractures and osteoporotic fractures. We know that vitamin D levels predict fractures, so people with low vitamin Ds are more likely to develop osteoporosis, more likely to have hip fractures, spinal compression fractures, the fractures that are associated with thin bones. And so there are a lot of randomized trials looking at vitamin D and fractures. but they're wildly different studies. Some, the average age is 53. Others, the average age is 85. So you can imagine, very, very different groups of people. Some are just randomized in the people living in nursing homes. Some have to be free living and generally healthy. Some had prior hip fractures, so already had osteoporotic fractures. Some, all of the people in the study had no prior fractures. So a lot of different kinds of studies. And the treatment varied from as little as 300 international units a day, so below the RDA, to 500,000 international units once a day, once a year. And sometimes they used D2, and sometimes they used D3. Sometimes they did it every day. Sometimes they did it every 3 months, every 4 months, every year. And sometimes they give calcium with it, and sometimes not. So it's a messy literature to sort through. And this is these are the randomized trials. Then you go to the observational data. It's even crazier. And the first big trial was in France in nursing homes. And lo and behold, it worked. 3,000 women, they gave vitamin D at just what's recommended now, 800 international units a day, and they gave the D3 form. And with a little 1,200 milligrams of calcium, about the RDA for calcium, and they compared it to a placebo. So a randomized trial, real drug, placebo. And they looked at hip fractures. It wasn't a huge effect, but we think this is a pretty big effect. So 2% absolute difference means that treat 50 women, you prevent one hip fracture. So 5% of the women in the vitamin D group had hip fractures, 7% in the placebo group. Make sure I'm not going to run too far out of time. And other kinds of fractures, you also saw a similar reduction, highly statistically significant. So we don't think this is due to chance. It's a randomized trial, so we really think this is a real effect of the vitamin D plus calcium. So great evidence. So how about the most recent trial? So this was in 2010. That other trial, when was that? 2002, New England Journal. One of the other premier journals in the world, the Journal of the American Medical Association. It was a study of a little over 2,000 women over the age of 70 in Australia. They had risk factors for hip fractures, but no osteoporosis. This is the study that gave them 500,000 international units a day. So that's, a year. That's equivalent to, 1,400 international units a day. So a little bit more than the other study. Really should work. But they didn't give calcium. And they actually found harm. There was a statistically significant, so something we believe in science is real in medicine, 15% increase in falls. And that led to a 26% increase in fractures. It went the other way. What's going on? So it's quite confusing. So this is, I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't have that on these slides. So that's the probability that this is due to chance. And in medicine, our threshold is a p-value of 0.05. It's a probability of 0.05 or lower. If it's lower than 0.05, that means there's less than a 5% chance that this is just random phenomenon. We happen to see this based on the sample in the study. And so if it's less than 0.05, we believe this is probably real. That's our standard in medicine. But we usually, like the FDA usually requires two studies like that because even that, you still can be wrong. But this was exactly the opposite of what was expected. So why the variation? So if you sort through all the studies, there really didn't seem to be due to the age of the people in these 25 trials or whether men or women were included or what their vitamin D level was to start off with, whether it was D2 or D3, the dose, frequency. It seemed to be that calcium supplementation, you needed the calcium supplementation for this benefit. It also happens that calcium supplement, all the studies with calcium supplementation did it every day. So it wasn't one of the studies where they did it every 3 months or 4 months or once a year. Those studies didn't use vitamin D in general. It didn't use calcium in general. So they were just vitamin D. So it appears that you need the calcium for the benefit. And if you look at the studies that used vitamin D plus calcium, there was overall an 18% reduction in hip fractures, statistically significant, way lower than 0.05. A 14% reduction in all fractures. And the benefits are, as is generally true, we want to target these therapies to people who are at high risk for the events we care about. So the people who are at risk for fractures are older people who've fractured before, and people who have low vitamin D to begin with. And there, the harms are pretty uncommon, though. I'll talk a little bit more about, there's some concerns about calcium now, and I'll talk about that study briefly in a minute. So, you know, the harms of the vitamin D plus the calcium are a little, you know, in studies where they gave these supplements, there was a little, some people did develop high levels of calcium, and that's associated, as I mentioned before, with constipation. It happens pretty rarely. About one in 100 people get this side effect. Above and beyond what sort of the normal background rate of constipation and high calcium. There were increases in kidney stones. So in the Women's Health Initiative, one of the randomized trials in the Women's Health Initiative gave 400 international units of vitamin D plus calcium. And they saw a few more kidney stones. It was statistically significant. The p-value was less than 0.05. So the probability is that that was a real phenomenon. But it was a pretty small difference, 2.5% in the group who got the calcium and vitamin D, 2.1% in those who didn't. That's actually 68 more kidney stones in those who were on the vitamin D group. And there were actually 63 fewer deaths. That wasn't statistically significant, but it sort of gives you the order of magnitude. I don't think this is a big issue for most people, but something to be aware of. Somebody who already makes kidney stones is at risk. You need to be careful about calcium and vitamin D supplementation. All right. So now I'm going to turn to all the other things that vitamin D does. So observational studies show low vitamin D is associated with an increased risk of colon cancer, an increased risk of breast cancer, an increased risk of prostate cancer, an increased risk of pancreatic cancer, or maybe some other cancers. So maybe it's important for preventing those diseases. There's an association with cardiovascular disease, strokes and heart attacks, something that's been talked about for generations of medical students is multiple sclerosis. We see more MS in the northern latitudes. We've known that epidemiologically, sort of looking at associations over time. People in the northern countries get more MS, and we don't understand, but they also have low vitamin D. There's an association with other autoimmune diseases. Multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease. The immune system is attacking the cells that wrap around nerve cells and affecting transmission. So type 1 diabetes, there's also an association. Rheumatoid arthritis, so these autoimmune diseases. And I'll show you some of the data about this. People who have low levels of vitamin D get more colds and flus. And they seem to have more chronic pain. And they are at higher risk for death. So here's data from NHANES, that's this national survey in the United States that looks at a representative sample. And you see that at low levels of vitamin D, we measure this with the 25-hydroxyvitamin D. This is sort of the storage form in fat and all. Those with low levels have a high risk of dying. So this this line is the risk of dying, and it's highest for the low levels of vitamin D, and it comes down till you get to around 20 to 30. This is part of the reason why the endocrinologists like 30 as the lower limit of normal rather than 20, what the Institute of Medicine said. But this is observational data that maybe low levels of vitamin D are associated with total mortality. And actually, in a meta-analysis of the randomized trials, seem to support that. There are 24 randomized trials that report death from any cause, mostly women, mostly older women. So women where half of the women were younger than 70, half older than 70. Vitamin D alone didn't affect mortality. So the studies that randomized people to vitamin D, that didn't affect mortality. But those with vitamin D and calcium, again, there was a significant reduction in mortality. It was small, 9%, but you're preventing 1 out of 11 deaths in these studies, potentially, with vitamin D plus calcium. And again, it was statistically significant, just a little below 0.02. Still possible that this is a chance finding, but pretty consistent in these studies. And that means you just need to give vitamin D and calcium to 151 people to prevent a death in 3 years, was what they estimated in this study. So pretty powerful that for an inexpensive potential treatment. And these are data from the same NHANES study in the United States looking at how often people had a cold by their vitamin D level. And they broke it out by winter, spring, summer, and fall because vitamin D levels tend to be lowest in the winter, and colds are most common then, and maybe that's just explaining the association. So they tried to look within the winter. Those with really low levels of vitamin D, less than 10, they were more likely, about a third of them, 30% of them reported a recent cold, whereas only 25% of those with sort of intermediate levels reported recent colds, and it was a little bit lower for those with high levels of vitamin D. And that was true in the spring, in the summer, and in the fall. During each season, people with the lowest levels of vitamin D had the most colds. So we did a randomized trial, just published at the end of last year. This trial was done in New Zealand. They like to study vitamin D in Australia and New Zealand. They took 322 healthy folks. Here they gave high dose, again, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin, it sticks around. They gave them 100,000 international units once a month, and they followed them for 18 months. Did it raise vitamin D levels? Yep. When they measured the vitamin D levels in the active group, was up to 48. In the placebo group, 25. So maybe they're already a pretty good level. But remember, that was that intermediate range in the prior slide, where that was the middle bar was in the 20 to 30 range. But what happened to colds? In the vitamin D group, over 18 months, on average, they got 3 to 4 colds, 3.7 colds per person during that 18 months. In the placebo group, exactly the same. So I'll go back to this slide. This probably is just that the healthier people who are doing other things that prevent colds have higher levels of vitamin D, and it has nothing to do with causality. Because when we randomize people and we really change people's vitamin D levels, had no effect on colds. Absolutely no effect at all. So again, we need to be careful with observational data. In medicine, I mean, in science, we try to think about those as hypothesis generating rather than definitive proof. And you need to go to randomized trials to really answer the question of whether it's causal or not. So there is a big randomized trial going on looking at lots of outcomes. In the United States, the same group that ran the women's health study that looked at aspirin in women but also looked at vitamin E in women, they're randomizing 20,000 healthy men and women to vitamin D3 at 2,000 international units, so a pretty high dose, versus placebo, and they're going to follow them for at least 5 years. And the study is ongoing across the United States, and hopefully we'll have an answer. I used to be excited about the vitamin D, and certainly there's some evidence that there's benefit in conjunction with calcium, but I'm less enthusiastic than I used to be. But stay tuned. This is a big study that will be presenting data in the next couple of years. And there's a similar study in Finland, and you can imagine in Finland, particularly in the wintertime, they have very low levels of vitamin D. And so they're doing the same thing, same level of vitamin D, about the same number of people. So we're going to have two randomized trials with 20,000 people each, where we'll have long-term follow-up for a number of different disease outcomes and really definitively answer whether it makes sense to be taking more than the RDA of vitamin D. And so what about calcium? So calcium does a lot. You know, it's really important for nerve transmission. Every time you contract a muscle, it's calcium moving across membranes that cause the muscle to contract. It's important for blood pressure regulation. You hear about calcium channel blockers. It's important for blood clotting. Calcium is involved in the clotting cascade. It's important for secretion of hormones, of digestive enzymes, of neurotransmitters. It helps some of the signaling. It's important for signaling. It activates a bunch of cellular enzymes. So calcium is involved with many, many processes in the body. Really important. It's not just bones. And it's not just bones and muscles. So the this is essentially the recommended daily allowance now, the DRI. For growing kids who are making bones, and they need about 1,300 milligrams a day of calcium. Most of us need about 1,000 as we get older, and concerns about osteoporosis, and again, not absorbing calcium as much. The RDA went up to about 1,200 milligrams. And women are not getting enough in general. Men do better at getting their recommended intake. But I noticed that, you know, twice the what's recommended is sort of the tolerable upper limit. You get twice what you need, and you start to run into problems with kidney stones and constipation and other problems from having calcium that's too high. And there are some concerns. I'm glad you brought up the clotting thing. That calcium, at least given in a supplement, it may be too much. So, and this is very controversial. There have now been two meta-analyses, studies where they take all the randomized trials and put them together because for some outcomes, the randomized trials may not be big enough to say definitively, yes, this causes something, or no, it's probably not, and this association may just be a chance finding. But there was, when you put all the randomized trials together, it looked like there was a 24% increase in heart attacks and highly statistically significant. So this was much less than a 5% chance that this was, a probability that this was due to chance. And they also saw strokes and heart attacks up. And so there are real concerns about calcium supplementation. And one of the thoughts, nobody understands, and it's very controversial, my osteoporosis colleagues poo-poo this a little bit. They think that the researchers who have publicized this sort of have an axe to grind. But the data are the data, and I'm sort of concerned about this. So I encourage my patients to get as much of their vitamin D from food, to minimize the amount that they get from supplements, thinking that it may be taking a big supplement may transiently really increase your calcium level. You may get this up and down of calcium in the blood. And maybe that affects clotting because heart attacks and strokes are the blood clotting in the artery. So it may just increase your tendency to clot a little bit. That's one theory. That's far from proven, but that's a hypothesis about why you might see this and why it might be bad to take a high-dose supplement. So encourage people to, eat low-fat dairy products and the fish with bones in them and things like that. Get their calcium from other sources. And in those who have to take supplements, I encourage them to take lower dose supplements a couple of times during the day rather than a big supplement all at once. So the question was, what about acidic foods and calcium? I think it's more, acidity in the urine affecting calcium excretion in by the kidneys. I don't think it's a big effect is the bottom line. And certainly you need enough acid actually to absorb the calcium in the intestines. So I think that's not proven, and sort of there's some reason, there's some theoretical reasons why that may be may have somewhat of an effect, but I don't think it has a big effect. I don't think the data suggests that it's a big effect. All right. So the take-home points on vitamin D and calcium. Vitamin D insufficiency is common, and as I said, the vitamin D level and the one we measure, the best measure of storage is the form that has one hydroxyl group, the 25-hydroxyvitamin D. That's because the one that I mentioned that's the hormone, the 1,2,5-dihydroxyvitamin D, that's tightly regulated. So the body doesn't allow that to go up or down too much. So it's not a good reflection of body stores. The 25-hydroxyvitamin D is the test that your doctor would order if they're measuring a vitamin D level. And if it's low, that predicts bone health. You're at increased risk for falls and fractures. And there's good data, I didn't present them, that not only does vitamin D plus calcium reduce the risk of fractures, but it reduces risk of falls. And in fact, that may be the most important effect. If you don't fall, you're not going to break your hip. So it may be the muscular function in preventing falls that's more important in this. 800 international units should be fine. 1,000 is not going to be toxic, so and often that's what supplements are, the easily available supplements. Most of the multivitamins have 800 international units now. I think that's plenty for most people, and if you're getting that, you don't need to get a vitamin D level measured. You want to make sure you're getting adequate calcium intake. If you're not getting enough from foods, then supplements. You want to use the lowest dose possible, like the 250 milligram Tums, a little bit with each meal, something like that, rather than 1,000 or 1,500 milligrams all at one go. And the testing, I think, is expensive and for most people unnecessary. I think it's reasonable when you're thinking about bone health, when somebody's measuring bone density, to also think about vitamin D. If there's a concern about an unusual cause of osteoporosis, then measuring a vitamin D. Otherwise, everybody should be getting a little extra vitamin D and making sure they're getting enough calcium. And the evidence for other diseases is pretty weak still. I think the best evidence is still preventing falls and fractures. All right. And then the last topic, omega-3s. So Epidemiologic Association in Greenland, they have a terrible diet. It's really high fat, which we thought, you know, that's where all they're thinking about high cholesterol and heart disease. They don't eat many vegetables, they don't have many fruits, but they don't get heart disease. What is it about it? The thinking was that it's these omega-3s in the fish that's causing us. So there are many different kinds of fats. The saturated fats are bad. Those are the beef fats and the dairy fats. That's why I want you to drink your milk or have your latte, but it should be skim milk or 1%, so the low fat. The monounsaturated fats are good. You know, the olive oil in the Mediterranean diet we've heard about being good for you. And then there are the polyunsaturated fats, and that's where the omega-3s are and the omega-6s. The omega-3s are the ones that are in fatty fish, but also in nuts, particularly walnuts and in flaxseed. You got to grind up the flaxseed to get to this. And there are also another form that's in corn oil, peanut oil, soy oil, and so on. So, and then the processed fats, the trans fats, which we now think are bad and are moving out of our food system. So I can't remember these names. The EPA and DHA are the good omega-3 fatty acids. Those are the ones that are in oily cold water fish, and that's the best source. Cod liver oil too. And the observation was that people who consume these have fewer fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular events when they looked at this very carefully. So observational studies, it's an association, may not be causal. This is the degree of the association. Just 1 to 2 servings per week of fish reduce the risk by about a third, the risk for death from heart disease. And it even reduced your risk of dying by almost 20% in observational studies. And what's happened in the United States? Well, omega-3 intakes have gone way down. So we used to eat a lot more fish at the turn of the last century. Omega-6 intake has increased, and there's an association of high omega-6 and low omega-3 with inflammation, which is another one of those things kind of like oxidative damage. We think it's just universally bad, that it causes cancer, that it causes heart disease. It's LDL itself, that kind of form of cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, doesn't really do anything unless it's oxidized. It's oxidized LDL that gets into the blood vessels and gets deposited and forms those atheromas that block our arteries. So oxidative damage inflammation is bad for, and that inflammation is associated with causing that oxidation. So inflammation is just generally bad. It's thought to be associated with cardiovascular disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, many of the degenerative diseases of aging. So American Heart Association says healthy people eat those 2 servings of fish a week. And, you know, plant-based sources of omega-3s are also good. And people with heart disease, they actually recommend supplements with a gram total of a mix of the EPA and DHA, which, I can't pronounce, so I just abbreviate. And what about the randomized trials? So there's a group in Italy called GISI, and they've done a tremendous number of randomized trials. They did some of the early randomized trials of thrombolysis drugs we used to give to break up clots and showed that you improve longevity. They have a long history of doing really high-quality randomized trials in heart disease. So in this study, 11,000 patients, more than 11,000 patients who just had a heart attack within 3 months of having a heart attack, they randomized them to either a gram of omega-3 fatty acids or placebo. And they saw a 21% reduction in total mortality. That 1 in 5 fewer people died, period, not from heart disease. Most of that was heart disease. And most of it was sort of sudden death, the kind of death where somebody is just doesn't wake up again, just dies suddenly, keels over and is dead. But we think of that as an arrhythmia. It's caused by a rhythm in the heart that prevents effective blood flow. And if blood stops flowing, you die very quickly. And there was a 45% reduction in this randomized trial in those events. But since then, this was published in 1999, so done in the mid to late 90s. Since then, In 2010, there were 5 studies in the biggest medical journals, so all huge studies, important. Not even a trend towards benefit after heart attacks, people with known heart disease, people with atrial fibrillation or trying to prevent atrial fibrillation. There was also, again, partly because of this oxidative theory, there was thinking that in people who are really sick in the intensive care unit with lung injuries where they can't breathe for themselves, we think that there's ongoing damage from inflammation in the lungs, and reversing that should help. So they gave omega-3s in a randomized trial. And those who got the randomized to the omega-3s, they stayed 3 extra days in the intensive care unit. And it wasn't statistically that was statistically significant, and there was a trend towards more deaths. So it wasn't statistically significant, but notice it was 0.054, and I told you that p-value of 0.05. If it had been 0.04, we would have said that was significant and it was a real effect. So that's sort of arbitrary. So there was a strong trend towards harm here. So really the opposite of what was expected. And I keep coming back to these meta-analyses, these studies where you take all of the randomized trials and try and make sense of them. So there have been 14 randomized trials of omega-3s, over 20,000 patients. This was in published last year. They used anywhere from 0.4 grams up to 4.8 grams a day. Remember the that original prevention trial that showed the benefit used 1 gram a day, and that was what the American Heart Association recommended for people with heart disease. The studies had up to 5 years of follow-up, on average 2 years, and they saw no reduction in all-cause mortality, no reduction in that sudden death that was where they had a 50% reduction in the initial, and no reduction in major cardiovascular events. Why is this? And it continues. There were 2 studies published since that meta-analysis, one in the New England Journal last year, one in the New England Journal just in May of this year. 12,000 patients in each, big studies, one with diabetes or near diabetes, one with people with many, many risk factors. They had to have like 4 risk factors for heart disease, and many of them did have heart disease. No reduction in deaths, no reduction in cardiovascular events in either study. Some pretty convincing evidence now that omega-3s don't work. How did it work in that first study? And now it doesn't work. I think the big difference now is statins. So when that first study was run, only about 20% of the patients in that study were put on a statin. Nowadays, we try and get everybody who has, particularly who has heart disease, somebody's had a heart attack, we put them on a statin. They don't leave the hospital without it unless they have a real contraindication to it or they have some bad side effect from it. So in these studies, 90-95% of the people were on statins. So that's probably the difference. If you're taking a statin, probably no benefit from the omega-3s. That may explain it. We're still not 100% sure what's changed, but it's been very consistent in all the large studies recently. So in summary on the omega-3s, I think there's no benefit in the modern era of medical therapy for vascular disease. There aren't any significant harms. Again, looking at total mortality as opposed to the antioxidants where there was a significant increase in total mortality. Here the trend, like in vitamin D, is towards fewer deaths in most of the trials. So it doesn't appear to be overall net harm, but I don't think there's a lot of benefit either. So probably not something to spend a lot of money on. So the bottom line, you know, we evolved to eat real foods. And when we isolate them from foods, or especially when we take them in high doses, I'm not as negative as this slide. I think there's a role for supplements in people who have trouble absorbing certain nutrients or who are deficient in nutrients. But we should be eating real foods. And, you know, we actually have a randomized trial of dietary therapy, which looked really promising. So that Mediterranean diet study where there were 3 arms, 7,500 people, a third of them were encouraged to have a Mediterranean diet with lots of olive oil, a third Mediterranean diet with lots of nuts, and the other third low-fat diet. And those on either the Mediterranean diet with olive oil or Mediterranean diet with nuts, they had a 30% reduction in strokes and heart attacks. So it really seemed beneficial. The Mediterranean diet was just eat your fruits and vegetables, have some tomato sauce with onions, eat fish regularly, and have some wine with dinner. And they discouraged sodas and sweets and sort of processed foods in general and processed meats. That was sort of the diet, and this seems sort of a healthy way to eat. Observational data, there's really good data from the Seventh-day Adventists. This was a trial just published earlier this year in the Journal of the American Medical Association. They followed 73,000 people, had about 25,000 deaths over 6 years of follow-up. And the Seventh-day Adventists mostly encourage a vegetarian diet. I went and gave a lecture down at Loma Linda University. It's wonderful. At their cafeteria, there's no coffee. It was terrible. but they had really, really good vegetarian food, and they had no meat at all. But there are some who eat fish, some who eat milk and eggs, some are semi-vegetarian. So they actually looked within all of these and compared different types of diets. And the bottom line outcome, I don't have all the data here for you, but the lowest mortality was in those who ate a little bit of fish or in the vegans, those who ate no meat products at all. And it was about a 15 to 20% reduction in total mortality in those two groups compared to those who were non-vegetarians. So in summary, beta carotene, don't do it. It's harmful. Don't take it. Take the RDA. It's fine having a little bit of beta carotene in a multivitamin, though I'm not a promoter of multivitamins. Vitamin E, don't take high doses. It's harmful. Folate, women of childbearing age, no question. We want to prevent neural tube defects. It's a real tragedy when a child has or a fetus has a neural tube defect. Vitamin D and calcium, I think there's benefit. There's concerns about harms with the calcium. You want to get the calcium as much as possible from foods. But you probably also just want to target the people who are at highest risk for fractures. So older people, people who are at risk for falling, those are the people we want to make sure are getting plenty of vitamin D and calcium. People with heart disease who are otherwise healthy, you may want to avoid the calcium, at least until we have better studies. And the omega-3s, I think there's really no benefit now. The people who we thought had benefit, the people who had heart attacks, those are people who are on statins now, and all of the randomized trials recently show no added benefit from the omega-3s. They make your triglycerides look a little bit better, your lipid numbers look better, but who cares what your lipids are if you don't have a heart attack, you don't have a stroke. If it's not helping you, don't take a supplement. So I agree with Michael Pollan. Eat real food, not too much, mostly plants, and I actually add, eat some fish. So not too much because we've poisoned our fish too with mercury and other heavy metals. But so that's my bottom line, and I'm happy to take more questions. The question is, what about probiotics? I mean, stay tuned on probiotics. So the idea of probiotics is, we have a trillion or more bacteria in our gut. And they've sort of co-evolved with us, and some are beneficial. And the probiotic pills are trying to give us back beneficial bacteria. I think when it's useful is when people are taking antibiotics. There's pretty good data now that you have lower risk for a kind of bacterial overgrowth that happens when you kill off good bacteria. So that C. diff, or Clostridium difficile colitis, the probiotics seem to help there, but it's very complicated. Each individual has very different mix of bacteria, and it's hard to know which probiotic mix is going to be right for you. I think we have a lot more to learn there. But the randomized trials really do show benefit now in preventing this kind of bacterial overgrowth syndrome, which is a big problem in people who are taking antibiotics. That's really the only time for it right now. So the question is, what testing I recommend for vitamin deficiency? I don't really routinely check for vitamin deficiency unless I have some reason to think that somebody's vitamin deficient. I mean, we worry about it in people who are alcoholics, people who are malnourished. Often we just give people back high dose, even intravenous in the case of alcoholics who often are deficient in many vitamins. I think about vitamin D deficiency in people with malabsorptive syndromes, and so sometimes we'll order a vitamin D level then. People who've had bariatric surgery that affects malabsorption. I think about it when I'm actually screening for osteoporosis. So at that point, I might not. Nowadays, I do order a vitamin D level because my patients want it. But I really don't think most need it. I think they should just be taking a vitamin D supplement or a multivitamin with vitamin D. Most of us just don't have high enough levels of vitamin D. And as we get to the age where osteoporosis and fractures are a problem, we really probably should be taking supplements. Zinc for a cold. There's good randomized trial evidence that if you take zinc lozenges every 2 hours all day long, you'll shorten the course of a cold by about an hour. Now, a little bit more than that, but not much. So, I mean, there's evidence that it works. But really, the randomized trial, probably people didn't take it quite as often as they were supposed to, but you have to take a lot. It's actually to shorten the course of a cold as opposed to prevention. So it's a treatment phenomenon, not that I think that I'm aware of. I don't know of any other data. But I should move. So the question was, can we trust the manufacturers, particularly if they're from China? So the Consumer Reports just looked at vitamin D, actually, and said that, essentially all the supplements were actually pretty accurate. I gave, at the end of the slide, there weren't slides I was going to talk about it, but at the end I gave some information about where to go for information about good quality supplements, manufacturers that are reputable. And there are websites for organizations that actually test supplements by manufacturer and say which ones are pretty accurate in what they have in them and which ones you should steer away from. So there are websites to go to look for individual things. Vitamin D seems pretty good. Most multivitamins are pretty good. Some of the supplements, you need to be careful about. I want to make sure I get a variety of people. Go ahead. So the question was about vitamins specifically for macular degeneration. As far as I know, there's not convincing evidence yet. I mean, there are associations, but again, from observational studies associating low levels of certain vitamins with macular degeneration. But randomized trials, there's no proven evidence that I'm aware of yet in that. In the back there. So the question was green tea and antioxidants. It's a good source of caffeine, keeps me awake sometimes. There are observational studies. Some of them also show that the black teas, the fermented teas, also are beneficial. It's sort of theoretical now. There's not convincing evidence yet. Doesn't seem to be harmful, but there are a number of people. There's a lot of active research in that area. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to figure out a way to effectively, minimize the bad antioxidants and yet allow, probably our body's native use of antioxidants of oxidation to still work unhindered. So I don't think we have an answer yet. It's an active area of research. People are really interested in it. There was a hand over here. Yeah. So the question was, those who are taking many daily supplements now, can they stop tomorrow? Absolutely. So the question is, if you had insufficient calcium earlier, is there a way to make up for it? I think the body tries to make up for things. Bone is the major storage for calcium in the body. And when people go into outer space, the astronauts they become osteopenic, osteoporotic really rapidly. I mean, because you need the stress of gravity and your body's weight on your bones to stimulate the bones to hold on to calcium or the bone is actually very active. It's constantly breaking itself down and building itself back. And if you don't stress it, it sort of shifts towards more breakdown than rebuilding. But when they come back, they build back up pretty quickly. So, I don't think you need to be overly concerned about that. Making sure you have adequate vitamin D so you can absorb what the body thinks it needs. Making sure you have an adequate source of calcium, I think, is the main thing. And then stressing the bones, so doing weight-bearing exercise is important. And that's tennis, that's walking, it's not swimming, but other kinds of things, even dancing and things like that, is weight-bearing exercise. So it's being up and stressing the bones. So the question was the amount of fish oil or omega-3s to take if you're going to take it. I mean, the recommendation, the one study that showed benefit used a gram And that was what that's still, I think, what the American Heart Association says is a gram is their recommendation, though they may be amending that soon. So that would be my recommendation. A lot of this marketing of these supplements started with the passage of a law in 1994 called the Deshaies Act, which basically banned the FDA from regulating the dietary supplement industry. And they can only act if there is evidence of harm, that they're actually doing harm to people, then they can step in and stop manufacturers. But the manufacturers, part of the reason that I think that dietary supplement use has gone up so high in the U.S. is companies have been able to market effectively. And, you know, our business school graduates are very good at figuring out how to market to us and get us to buy things. And I think the krill oil is probably mostly that. There's almost always a little bit of science behind it. But it's usually spun way beyond where the state of the science. Absolutely. So the question is, if people aren't eating right, is it okay to take supplements? I mean, I think that's part of the problem. The people who need the supplements are not taking them. You know, it's people who have a poor diet, who aren't getting adequate vitamins. You know, they're not the ones who are taking the vitamins in the United States. And the one trial, so I think a multivitamin usually has plenty to meet the needs of most people, even if they're eating poorly. So taking a good quality multivitamin, and I tell people to go to Costco and get one of the least expensive ones so that they can afford to do it, or wherever.
Make sure you have some of everything.
Yeah, but it's far better to spend the money on, eating real food. So the question is how to get real food. That's a controversial. I even fight with my wife over this. She tends to buy organic. I'm not convinced that the benefits are always worth the economic output. I think getting high quality, tasty food is the most important thing. And farmers markets are a great place. Organic food is probably. I mean, there's evidence that the nutrient quality is a little bit higher. And there's less pesticides, so it's probably better, but it's so much more expensive that that's not feasible for everybody. But avoiding processed foods, buying the foods and cooking them yourself is still a much better way. Then you can control what's in. I should probably call it quits for the formal questions. I'm happy to take more at the back, but I want to let everybody feel free to leave.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.